Welcome to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. At a recent talk on the theme of teenagers' educational and career choices, a parent of a teenager said, "I know my daughter better than she knows herself, so she should listen to me." In response, a guidance counselor said, "Parents are always wrong when it comes to advising their teenage kids about educational choices." Later in the show, something new. Your Career Buzz hosts, Leanne Sachs and myself, in conversation about the teenager, their parents, the educators, and the choices. Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of Career Cycles, a career management social enterprise. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz, and thanks for tuning in this morning. After completing a degree in English literature and an MBA, Andrew Fitzgerald worked in banking in Toronto for 5 years. Itching to travel, he quit his job and set off for Vietnam to live and work, where he found a banking job that led to other ones in Singapore and Manila and Hong Kong. And along the way, he and his wife fell in love with Asian art. Ready for a change, they returned to Toronto and began researching the idea of an Asian art gallery here in Toronto. We're going to talk to Andrew Fitzgerald and how he fulfilled his dream by founding the East Gallery, now showing Hanoi Dreams at the Art Square Gallery. Welcome, Andrew, to Career Buzz.
Hi, thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
Great. Now, what do you like about your new career running an art gallery?
Yeah, I mean, it's so different than what I was doing before. To begin with, the interpersonal side has been fantastic. So meeting the artists in Burma, in Vietnam, meeting the art lovers in the gallery and having conversations about art, about these countries, about travel. Certainly running the project from end to end has been very satisfying. So seeing all parts of the project and then seeing it in a realized state, kind of a completed, it's almost tangible that you can put your hand on these exhibitions and you can see the play of art and you get immediate feedback from people.
It's amazing. I actually went to the opening just last week, and to see what you're doing now in contrast to what you were doing earlier in your career in banking. I want to talk to you about that transition, but first, in this new career that you're doing, you're drawing on a variety of strengths and skills, possibly some transferred from your earlier career. What does it take? What are you drawing on in terms of skills and strengths to pull this off?
I think the interpersonal side, definitely. The ability to connect with the artists. I feel like I've been able to develop a very good rapport with the artists. And that's something that when I was working in banking in Asia, a lot of my time was spent with 98% of our staff, in fact, were what we termed as local staff. So I'm used to that intercultural relationship. And also with the art buyers, I think having the conversations with them. I guess one of the surprising things is, to me, is that the things that I really love in art, the kind of images that I really love, seem to be resonating with people. And I wasn't sure about that ahead of time, whether people would see in my taste something as well. And that's been something that's been very satisfying for me.
That's great. So sharing your interest, sharing your demonstrated interest in Asian art and your love for it is rubbing off. And that's so great. And I want to really emphasize in your transition how a demonstrated interest, something that you really like and care about, can be the seed of a big career change, but still draw on so many of the skills and strengths that may come from a totally different field. So let's step back in your story and figure out how all this happened. Now, I said in the intro, you did a degree in English and then an MBA. Those aren't two things that obviously go together. What first led you back in those university days to study English literature?
You know, I think in retrospect, a lot of it comes to my parents, and probably for most people that's the case. And in a way, my parents represented two distinct poles. There's the Apollonian and Dionysian sort of split. And
yes.
So my mom was really from the Dionysian side. She loved to go out, loved culture, impulsive, liked to shop. On the other hand, there was my father, who was very rational, careful, logical, really the opposite. And I guess I carry both of those inside of me. And I feel, in retrospect, when I look at English, that was really an objective to develop myself, to approach university in that older traditional way of enlightening myself about the world. But I didn't feel that it was a very practical thing to be taking. So all along, I was thinking, in the end, I'm going to have to go to business school to get a job. And that was really my father's voice coming through, I think.
So you've actually melded the two perspectives with these quite different areas of study. You said you were thinking about business school. It's not what's on the top of mind of most English majors. Were there any other career ideas that you had while you were busy studying English?
You know, Mark, I think I didn't do enough reflection on this Yes. at a young enough age. And so it seemed like I was on a path into business that I didn't really reflect on very much. It was just instinctive. And at the same time, I don't feel that I had a lot of models to guide me in terms of a variety of different career options. So all I knew was what my father did and some of his friends, and they all seemed to be in business. So that seemed to be the way to go.
So then off to MBA school. What did you like about that? And how was that for you being coming from such a different background? You're probably sitting next to, you know, engineers and other people who did BCOMs and these more traditional things. And there you were, the English major, sitting in that group. How was that for you?
Yeah, it was strange. I mean, at the Dean's Tea, which opens the year, I kept having the feeling somebody was going to come over and tap me on the shoulder and say, you know, take my teacup away and say, I'm sorry, we've made a mistake and you're no longer invited to the MBA program. I think at that Dean's Tea, I was the only one not wearing a jacket.
Yes. So it's kind of that imposter syndrome. You hear that a lot throughout the economy. People often feel like they're an imposter. They don't really belong. And it sounds like you had, at least starting, you had some of that going on.
There was. But once I got into it, I really felt, it was a very intense program, quite stressful. Amazing support amongst the students. And so that interpersonal, I guess, really helped us get through it. And what I took away from it were a lot of models in which you could use to approach different problems, so, and find solutions to them and do analytical work. And that helped me in my business career, but certainly that's also been helping me in terms of the art gallery.
And then when you graduated from the MBA, and like lots of listeners who may be either going to graduate shortly or recent grad still trying to make a go of it, how did that very first important job come together for you?
Yeah, so that was a bit of a disaster, to be honest, because I didn't follow the program of on-site, on-campus
Yes.
career discussions. I decided that I wanted to live overseas and I was going to be approaching companies on my own to get a posting overseas, which wasn't very smart and not very realistic. And so, in fact, I went through a period of about a year of not working and then finally was hired by TD Bank.
When you say finally hired, how did that come together? Was that a referral? Did you apply directly? What was the mechanism?
So there was a referral through a family member to somebody that they knew at Toronto Dominion.
Still leading to an interview and still going through that process.
That's right.
So the referral actually just opened a door for an opportunity to interview without it being a shoo-in.
That's right.
All right, important to know. We're talking to Andrew Fitzgerald here. He's a banker turned art gallery owner here on Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CIUT.FM worldwide. So, Andrew, there you were now working in the world of banking. You had wanted to go overseas, but that didn't quite work out. So, but you spent a few years working here in Toronto in the banking industry. What led to that big change where you let go of everything after 5 years and said, I want to now travel?
Yeah, I had never lost that desire to be living overseas and working in international business, say. So after 5 years, I'd got to the point where I had paid off my student loans. I had a little bit of money saved up. And so then I really felt like it's now or never. I have to act on this dream of living overseas or just forget about it. So at that point, I took a 3-week vacation. I went to Singapore, Vietnam, and Thailand, met with some bankers in those locations, in order to see which country there might be the best opportunity for me. And out of that vacation trip, that 3-week trip, I came back to Toronto, left my job at TD, and moved over to Vietnam, where there did look to be some good opportunities in the banking area.
So there was a kind of preliminary trip, to a reconnaissance trip, to check it out. So that's a really interesting idea. Now, if listeners are thinking, gee, wouldn't it be great to work and live overseas, can you just say a little bit about setting that up? You know, and if you go to some place that you're unfamiliar with, how to get enough of an understanding of what's going on in a certain field so that you can get some confidence that, yeah, I could find a job. Did you line up meetings in advance? How did you do that?
So there were some meetings lined up ahead of time through TD Bank and through some other people I knew. That gave me some people in Singapore. In Vietnam, it was really walking in the door and meeting people that way, which sounds amazing, except that the banks in Vietnam at that time, the foreign banks, were very small. They might be 10 or 15 people. In some cases, they were just representative offices of 3 or 4 people. So it was, in fact, very easy to come in and sit down and have a conversation with somebody off the street. I also was buying the newspaper, so I was getting the South China Morning Post, the Singapore paper, the Thai paper. That was available in Toronto. I think now with the internet, this is all pre-internet days, I think now with the internet, there would be better opportunities through LinkedIn and whatnot. But I really think it's important to look before you leap if you're thinking about going overseas.
That's great to hear that there's ways to do that. Look before you leap. Now we have the internet. You could read those newspapers online. You could connect with people on LinkedIn who are working in country A or B. So if listeners are thinking about that, it's doable. You don't have to rely on an internal transfer, because I think a lot of people think, okay, well, I'm going to wait for my company to send me to wherever. And you don't have to do that. You can be more proactive. And it worked in your case. Mm-hmm. How was it when you said goodbye to your colleagues here in Toronto? I'm quitting. I'm leaving. I'm going to go to Vietnam. Did they think you were nuts?
Absolutely. I mean, I had questions about, because I was moving to Vietnam, you know, is the war over?
Yeah.
But still, it was 1995, so it had been over a long time. So there was, I think, quite a bit of incomprehension. But more importantly, from my father and my mother, they were both very supportive, and they'd been hearing about this dream for a long time. So they were probably thinking, okay, enough already. Maybe this will get it out of his system. So
they were supportive. They didn't say, supportive. Don't do it.
Not at all.
But the folks back at TD Bank, they thought, nuts, don't do it.
I think so.
So there you are. You land in Vietnam. Where did you go? Was it Hanoi or Ho Chi Minh City?
First Ho Chi Minh City. Looked and met some bankers there, and then was up in Hanoi a month later and was meeting bankers there. And that's where I ended up getting hired in Hanoi.
And so how did that happen? Just, you know, it's always curious, how do people get hired? And here we are in Canada. It's hard enough for people to figure out how to do that in their own culture. How did you do that there? What's the system? How do you apply for a Vietnamese banking job?
Yeah, I think the important factor was that the economy was really taking off. And locally, they didn't have people in Vietnam who understood Western banking practice. I had experience in Western banking practice. So the opportunity there was with all the foreign banks that were rushing into Vietnam, they could bring in an expat who would be very expensive, or they could hire me. And the way I marketed myself was that I was somebody with experience, but much cheaper than an expat that they would fly in with family and all the costs associated with that.
Oh, so you made a nice pitch to them that was, they get something that they want and at a less cost. So it's kind of like a proposal, or, you know, it's a business skill there. And what was the job, just to make it clear, what were you doing at TD that you thought would be transferable to East Asia?
Yeah, it was essentially kind of a retail corporate banking job. So my job at TD was overseeing or selling to companies services that help them to execute payments, to collect their money, to keep track of all their transactions through electronic banking, and to make day-to-day investments in time deposits if they had a bit of extra money. So it wasn't rocket science. If I had been an investment banker, I probably would have gone to Singapore or Hong Kong. It was very sort of retail corporate banking.
And that's what they needed at the time.
Exactly.
Perfect. All right. So that's another thing to think about is what does the country that you're targeting, where are they at and how might you fit with their work environment? What about language skills? Like here we are speaking in English. How was your Vietnamese at that point?
Yeah, not existent. I did learn a bit by the end of 3.5 years in Hanoi. But the foreign banking in Asia happens in English, and that even applies to banks like Deutsche Bank. I can't talk for the Japanese banks, but certainly the German banks are speaking in English in Asia. They'll have staff from all over. They're not just hiring German staff. French banks hire people from different countries, not just from France. So often the common language is English, and that was not an issue.
That's amazing. So it's the lingua franca everywhere. You're just going to be able to use that. Aren't we lucky that we have English as our first language? So somewhere along the line, you fell in love with Asian art. It sounds like that was part of the story there. And I know there's a personal story that parallels the professional story, because somewhere along the line, you're there with your wife falling in love with mm-hmm. Asian art. Take us into that side of things, the personal, and how did that work, and where did the Asian art kind of insight start for you?
Sure. I met my wife actually when I was pretty fresh off the boat in Vietnam. So it was within about 4 weeks of getting there. I was still unemployed. I'm sure she thought not such a great prospect. But over the course of 6 weeks, we spent a lot of time together just as friends. And it was through that period that we fell in love. And she went back to Germany after that 6 week period, but then ended up coming back after about 6 months, so keeping me waiting a bit. But and through her, she knew some of the Vietnamese artists.
Yes.
She is a journalist, and she had done some stories with the Vietnamese artists. And so we became quite good friends with a number of the Vietnamese artists. And in the early days, in the first half of our time in Vietnam, we were living a very local life. We were riding one of the small motorbikes.
Yes.
And living in very small kind of quarters inside the city. And it was a great time where we spent in the evenings going out to art opening receptions. There wasn't a lot else to do in Hanoi in the evenings, and having the artists over to our houses. And it was a very wonderful time, and was actually the country where we got closest with the local population, because in some of the other countries, for whatever reason, you're just kind of living apart from them.
Yes.
And they see you as passing through, which you are. But it was really in Vietnam that we developed the best relationships, and that was to a large extent with local artists.
So it must have been a really exciting time. I mean, you know, you meet your future wife, you're having an exciting kind of career adventure, and you're having this parallel interest in art all come together. If you reflected in that moment on what you discovered in Vietnam compared to where you were at, kind of hankering for it when you were still back in Toronto, did you feel like you were on cloud nine? Did you feel like, wow, this is amazing?
Yeah, 100%. The day I got hired, I remember thinking, this is the best day of my life. And this is a dream that I had been nagging at me really since high school. The idea of not just travel, but actually live someplace and kind of get to know it to a much greater extent, to really feel it through the seasons rather than just pass through as a
yes.
tourist. And in the first, well, really the whole time in Vietnam, there were ups and downs. It was a bit of a roller coaster emotionally, because you are out there on your own.
Yes.
And at times there were conflicts with, you know, local staff or with the job or whatever. But the highs were very high, and the lows could be a bit low as well.
It's a, you know, for anybody who's thinking about living their dream, I mean, it's amazing to take the risk, because that's the thing that you did, is you took the risk. Let's try it. And not everybody's up for that. But, you know, there's no guarantees in life. It might not have worked, and maybe there were some crazy times there with the downs. But boy, nice going. Congratulations on pulling that off.
Thank you.
We're talking to Andrew Fitzgerald here. He's now the owner of the East Gallery in Toronto, former banker. Here on Career Buzz, I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM and CIUT.FM worldwide. So how did it then go, Andrew? I said in the intro, it didn't just stop in Vietnam. You were in Manila and Singapore and Hong Kong. How did all of that happen, you know, in terms of moving around? And then what happened with the interest in the Asian art?
So Citibank has a big operation out in Asia, and what they do is I had the opportunity to move to their program in Singapore and then Manila, Hong Kong, and then London. And it was through career advancement and kind of shifting of employees into different countries.
And was it you who initiated it? Were you ready to pick up? It sounds like you were having a really great life in Vietnam. What, you know, did they say, hey, Andrew, it's time for you to move off to Manila or whatever? Did you say, I'm ready for a move?
In Vietnam, I had to work hard to get on the radar screen because Vietnam was a small operation for them, and the decision makers for HR would have been in Singapore and Hong Kong. So I definitely had to work hard to get on people's radar screen and to get into a cycle of transfer. Once I got to Singapore, I was moved after a year and a half, and that was too early. I would have loved to have stayed longer.
Yes.
Manila was 2.5 years, which was okay. Hong Kong was 5 years, which was brilliant. So in some cases, the music would come to an end with a job, and it was a bit like musical chairs where all of a sudden a chair is taken away. And you yourself had to do quite a bit to get the next job. You
yes.
had to use your own internal network at the bank to do a job. Often nothing would be lined up for you, and there was no defined career path that you would be taking.
Just for listeners maybe in an organizational setting now or podcast listening later who work in an organization and who are thinking, you know, how do I move around in this organization? You just mentioned the use or the connecting to people, having a network and talking to them. What advice do you have about internal networking within an organization to get yourself on the radar screen, to get your desires known as well?
I think it's very important to be meeting people, not just in meetings at the office, but where possible, going out for a coffee, go out for lunch. I think it's important to show really who you are, to reveal yourself so that you can develop a deeper kind of personal bond with people, and to have ideas that don't necessarily apply just to your specific area, but
yeah.
ideas that the organization could be doing that are bigger picture ideas. And in that, you show that you are bigger than the job that you are currently doing.
Great advice. Thanks for sharing that. I think that's really helpful to listeners thinking about that particular angle of career management and developing their careers for the future. So something happened after this great swing of opportunities here. You left Asia and you went to London. And so that's one transition. Eventually, you land back in Toronto. What was the arc of that, you know, as the whole banking career kind of moved throughout Asia and then over to London? How were you feeling about it, and where did the seeds of change start to show up?
I think really from the beginning and from my time in Toronto, I never felt that banking really fulfilled me. It was more of a means to an end. There were definitely some positive aspects to it. I liked the fact that the product was information and money. I found that a compelling product. But I think throughout, I never felt completely fulfilled by the banking. And my wife will agree with me in this. We kept talking about having, okay, one more country. Every time a new move came up, it was, okay, this one more country, and then that's it. And it was one more and one more and one more. I always wanted to come back to Toronto. I never expected to be gone. I ended up being gone 14 years. I never expected it would be that long. But each of the opportunities were financially rewarding. I loved the different countries that I was moving to. And so you kind of continue on almost perhaps a little bit out of inertia. It
yes.
also is kind of the easier thing to do is just to carry on with this program.
Path of least resistance.
That's right.
And your spouse, I mean, she has her career also. Was she flexible and portable with her career as you move from place to place?
Yeah, that's a major issue for expatriates, that what they refer to as the trailing spouse.
Yes.
And luckily, my wife is a journalist and in communication, so she was able to some extent, reinvent herself in each move and was also able to get contracts to do some work in each of the moves. But I think for people with I don't know, more traditional jobs, spouses with more traditional jobs, that can be a real issue, because all of a sudden the husband who's used to working, let's say the wife gets transferred overseas, the husband is all of a sudden an at-home husband with the kids.
Yes.
And in reality, the expat community in Asia is quite traditional. It's typically is the men who are working and the wives are not working. And there's it's a very sort of traditional, almost 1950s kind of environment.
But she was working and she had portability.
That's right.
What would she say about all of this? Was she thrilled with the opportunity to keep moving around, or was she the one saying, no, I'm just getting settled here. Let's not go to Manila.
Yeah, definitely in terms of Singapore. She was very unhappy to be leaving Singapore. She had a job with CNBC. Most of the moves she was not so jumping at. I mean, she really was loving where she was.
Yes.
I was the one who often wanted to shake things up a little bit. And I think partly that was to freshen up work, because I found over time it just got a little bit stale.
Yes.
And to move to a new country was to have like a whole new game.
And the possibility of starting a family, that's something else that people might be thinking about, those who are working overseas, and they think, well, when's that going to happen? So how did that fit into your plans?
We had our first daughter after 3 years in Hanoi. So she's had about six moves. She's 12 years old now, so she's had six moves in her life.
Wow.
Luckily, she's very young, so that I don't think it's kind of adversely affected her.
Yes.
And then we had our second child in Singapore. Having young kids in Asia is actually brilliant, because you can get some, like a nanny, very, very reasonably priced. You can have a housekeeper and all of that. So actually the lifestyle out there can be very, very easy, with no obligations beyond work. And
yes,
then your weekends and your evenings are free to with your family, which was wonderful. But at a certain point, I really felt it was important to get back to Canada for a number of reasons, both for myself, for my wife, but also for the kids, to
yes,
give them a sense of home. They their mother is German, so if you ask them the question, where are you from, a couple of years ago, they would say, do you mean where was I born? What passport do I have? Where were my parents from? Where do I live right now?
Five different answers to five different questions.
That's right.
Yes.
And so that whole sense of identity, and for me, Toronto and Canada, I feel, is very important to my own sense of identity, and I wanted to give that to the kids as well.
That's amazing. We're just at about 11:30, Andrew. I want to continue on and for listeners to be able to hear this next piece of the story, where we have the career shift, because you do move back to Canada some years ago, and then all of this gallery work starts. So we're going to continue the conversation just after the break. We've been talking to Andrew Fitzgerald here, the East Gallery owner here in Toronto. And I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT or CIUT.fm. You brought a piece of music in, Andrew. We just realized, though, it was a Robbie Robertson piece, right? And
yes,
we just had some technical difficulties, but we do have a backup piece of music by the band.
Great.
That Robbie Robertson had played in. What was the song that you brought in? What was the connection with Robbie Robertson?
Yeah, the song was Somewhere Down the Crazy River, and there was just a set of lyrics that I loved, which was, I'm a man with a clear destination, I'm a man with a broad imagination. And I thought, in terms of a career discussion, I love those two lines, because even if you don't have a clear destination, having a broad imagination can help you to find your way.
So that's great. What we have is Robbie Robertson with the band with We Can Talk.
We can talk about it now in that same way. From the Roots Up. CIUT 89.5 FM, broadcasting live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. From Hart House, University of Toronto.
We're back at Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. And before continuing our interview with Andrew Fitzgerald, I wanted to let listeners know the Enriching Lives and Careers trip to Nicaragua, a service learning experience, Feb 23 to March 2, building a transitional house alongside the family who will live there. Connect to locals, enjoy excursions, meet remarkable change makers. Let us know if you're interested today or tomorrow. Check careercycles.com and click on Enriching Travel for details. We're talking to Andrew Fitzgerald here. He's a banker turned art gallery owner. We've just followed his trajectory of his career story from Toronto throughout Asia, East Asia, Southeast Asia. Andrew, you eventually moved to London and then came back to Toronto, partly for personal reasons, but partly for career reasons too. Can you take us into, I guess, the end of the banking career for you and where the seeds of that began?
Sure. I had been doing banking for 20 years by the time we got to London. The London move was really an effort to try to extend this a little bit further because, frankly, I was very much burning out on the whole banking program. I felt stressed out. I felt my health was suffering. And I also felt like I was doing the same job year after year. And in fact, over almost 15 or 20 years, I had that feeling. And thinking that at the end of the day, when, I don't know, some people say when you write your obituary, just that they would say a banker and that would be the end of it in terms of my productive work life really bothered me.
Yes.
At the same time, I felt like I was running out the clock. This was a phrase that was very much in my head, trying to work enough years to get enough money up for retirement. But at the same time, I started thinking, you know, that's a terrible way to lead your life, to be running out the clock. And so leaving London, it was really a desire to develop a second career before I was too old. I was, 46 or 47 at the time. And to return to Canada, which was very primary to me, but also to have some create something that had more meaning to me.
Yes. So you came back. Did you have it lined up? Did you have any plan, or did you just say, I quit, leave the bank in London, and then, you know, land in Toronto with a family in tow, wife, two kids? You know, how was that to come here?
So I did the latter, which was not following the look before you leap program.
Yes.
I felt it was difficult while working at the bank, given the hours and stress levels that we had, to really have the time to figure out what my heart was telling me I should be doing and to figure out what I really wanted. And so in moving back to Toronto, there was no idea of what I was going to do. I had a few ideas. I was thinking about possibly going into psychology or sociology and a couple of ideas, but mostly it was a clean slate. And one friend of mine, when I told him it was kind of clearing my palate between two meals, he described it as my sorbet period. But I think it was really important to do that, to kind of clear my mind of everything and open myself up to things that would come from the outside, as well as listen to my heart as to what was important.
And so what bubbled up? What came up for you in your sorbet period where you realized, gee, the Asian art thing, what about that?
Well, that really came from my wife. She noticed that there was virtually no Asian art available in Toronto. You know, some gallery might have one Chinese artist or an Indian artist, but it's all very random, as if these artists appeared out of nowhere. At first, I didn't believe her, and I did. But then when I looked into it, it was the case. And in fact, Asian art is very big in New York and London and Tokyo, Hong Kong. So it seemed amazing that a city as global as Toronto really had nowhere to show all the exciting things going on in Asia. So, and then, you know, all the pieces just fell into place, you know, like the lock, you know, with all the wheels. It was starting to do some research, started to realize I could do this, and I already love art, and you don't need an advanced degree for it. A lot of people do have the history of art degrees, but in fact, you don't have to go back to school for 3 years or 5 years. And so this is something we could do. And so really, that was the genesis.
I like the way you said pieces started to fall into place. You know, for many people, there's this idea of, I got to have it all figured out. And, you know, and I got to be able to tell everybody what I'm doing. And yet, there were some clues for you. There was the clue of your own demonstrated interest. There was the clue of your wife giving you this idea that there isn't much Asian art. And so those clues, and I think this is one of the mechanisms by which careers unfold in good ways, is that when you see clues, you feel motivated, you feel inspired to take action that almost feels hard not to do. So you started to research, what's out there, what can I do? Was that research hard and difficult and a painful experience, or was it something that you just felt like compelled to do?
It was fun. It was the internet played a huge part, and I never could have got this project up and going without the internet, being able to troll through galleries in London, Tokyo, New York, or whatever, and find work that I liked and reacquaint myself with the Vietnamese art scene and Burmese art scene. But as well, a lot of it was about just walking into the galleries and talking to the gallery owners or the people working there.
And you said fun. Like, I don't want listeners to lose that word. It felt like fun.
Yeah.
Right? Compare that, and some listeners may experience this, to, gee, I want to change careers. Let me go find job postings online and fire off resumes for months on end without hearing anything. How fun is that? You know, and it's what most people are doing. And yet you felt compelled to go walk into galleries and check things out on the internet and do all of that inspired action. And ultimately, it led to some degree of confidence, like, hey, I can do this. So what did you then do to turn this kind of positive experience into the reality that it is today?
So at that point, we decided to, my wife and I, she's a major partner in the gallery, and she manages the website and the Twitter program and upcoming newsletter and whatnot. What we decided to do was take a careful approach to it in a more staggered rollout. So we have been holding exhibitions in various art galleries. I kind of think of them as pop-up exhibitions, in order to test the market for their feedback on the work that we were showing and some of the work and artists that my wife and I had chosen. Do these artists and artwork resonate with the people? And also to build a database of contacts, because that's something that art galleries live and die off of.
Yes.
And we didn't have anything for that. So by going into different galleries, we were able to get our invitation sent out to their whole database and start developing our own.
Right. So leveraging other people who are doing some related things. And that worked. All right. So you've now had, I think, what, you're on your third exhibition.
That's
is that right?
That's
and
right.
How's it been going?
It's the most rewarding time that I've ever had. It's amazing. During the Burma exhibition, which was last month, I was thinking in a 2-week exhibition, I had more meaningful human interactions than I had in a 15-year career with the bank overseas.
Wow. That's an amazing thing to hear you say.
It's right. Quite sad in a way,
yeah.
I think, in terms of the 15 years I had at the bank. But it was so rich in people, for example, Burmese people who had moved here, talking about their life stories, which came up as they saw the artwork from their country.
Yes.
Other Asian people that were so pleased to see work from their continent being shown here. And just conversations with, we had an author came in, and, you know, meeting her, Karen Connolly, was brilliant. It was the most fun, and I am having the most fun, you know, on all sides of the business.
Your face is lighting up as you say this. You're smiling. Listeners can hear it. Okay, so we've heard how great it was. There's meaning and there's purpose, and there's an intense connection with who you are. Listeners want to know this other question that I'm going to ask you now, because I always get asked, like, you should have pushed him on the money side and the financial side. And how real is this? And, you know, you're making decent money, presumably, as a banker. How is this working out financially?
So with the three exhibitions, the second one broke even on a variable cost basis. So that's all the costs associated with that exhibition, but not covering my salary.
Yes.
I'm expecting within about a year to be covering all expenses, but not my salary. And in a year or two, I really need to start covering my salary. The art business is a tough business to make money in. We have taken an approach and a model, though, that minimizes our costs. So, and with the economic times and building up our own contact list, we're taking a very kind of careful approach. We will have a permanent space starting July, but we won't need to be adding people to the whole program.
Great. So it's doable. In fact, we had a guest on Career Buzz a while ago, Dimitri from Spearhead Brewery, and he did the same thing. He was in London and said, I want to start something completely new, and why not? I can do a brewery. But he didn't buy the equipment. He rents it out, and he brews his beer in somebody else's facility so that he can then market it and start in a phased approach. So there are these ways of getting started with your dream job, so to speak, and creating that dream job without it breaking the bank right off the top. And that's, it sounds like you've done that. So where is this, if listeners want to know, where is this new gallery? What can listeners do to check you out?
So right now, the Hanoi Dreams exhibition is at the Art Square Gallery and Cafe, which is immediately across from the Art Gallery of Ontario at 334 Dundas Street West. We have a show in March for Asian female artists, which will be for a whole month. Cambodian photography will be in May and participating in the Contact Photo Festival with photographers that are all Cambodian, not foreigners taking pictures of Cambodian things. And then July, we're full-time in the same location. The Art Square will be with the cafe, will be taking over their front gallery space. So that's 334 Dundas Street West.
Great spot. I mean, I was there this past week. It was so nice to have the gallery in the front and food and beverage. And it's just a great combo.
Yeah.
Makes total sense. And if people want to find out more on the internet, what's the website?
It's at www.theeastgallery.com.
Great. Andrew, finally, let me just ask you back to the personal of this whole arc of your career and life that you've told us about, which is just astonishing and rewarding too, from where you've been to where you are now. What can you share with listeners about what you've personally learned about making career and life choices?
That's an excellent question. I think it sounds a little cliche, but you need to listen to your heart. You need to avoid being influenced overly by fear. Often, actually, choices can be reversed.
Yes.
And so when I initially went over to Asia, I certainly had in my mind that I could go back to TD Bank and probably get my old job back. So was I really risking very much in going to Asia? I didn't feel that way. I think a lot of times it seems much bigger. And so if you do take some steps, you can solve the challenge rather than trying to look at the overall challenge and trying to solve it in one go.
Right. Great advice. Andrew Fitzgerald, thank you so much for joining us
here
on Career Buzz.
Been
a great, great story. We're talking to Andrew Fitzgerald here on Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM. And we've got a few minutes now, about 15 minutes, that I want to shift gears to something a little bit different, a career conversation between myself and one of our co-hosts, Leanne Sachs. The story is that at a recent talk I was at on the theme of teenagers' educational and career choices, a parent of a teenager in grade 11 said, "I know my daughter better than she knows herself, so she should listen to me," said the parent. And in response, there was much conversation about that, as you can imagine, and a guidance counselor said parents are wrong when it comes to advising their teenage kids about educational choices. They don't really know what's what. So today I thought we would get Leanne on the phone and talk a little bit about this issue, and if listeners have comments or questions, to call in and let us know. Leanne, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Mark.
So great to have you here on the show again, and good to be in conversation with you about this. Now, you and I have both been working for years and years with clients asking these big career and life questions, and I wanted to have a conversation with you about this, focusing especially on younger people. And when we talk about young people, you know, there's people in high school or in their early 20s. You know, let's try and both get inside their own hearts and minds, but let's also talk about the pressures that they're under. What do you see as some of the pressures or the influences on young people these days in making educational and career choices?
Well, Mark, that's a really good question, because I think that a lot of their beliefs that come from well-meaning and well-intentioned adults and society in large is that we're supposed to make these decisions, lifelong decisions, when we're 15 or 16 or maybe even 18 years old. So when you were speaking just now to Andrew about, you know, how your career is this journey and how it twists and turns and it does different things, it's not necessarily a straight line, that's so important to know that once they you know, the conflict people are typically in those years is that they their belief is that you're going to pick a work that has to be satisfying, it has to have everything that you want met immediately, and it has to be something that's going to make huge amounts of money at the same time, and they have a whole bunch of beliefs that are in the way and kind of hindering they're making any steps forward into something that they may enjoy.
Yeah, so the bar is really high, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? And that's the perception. You have to make one choice, make it really early, and make a stupendously good choice.
Yeah, you can't make a mistake, right?
And you can't make a mistake.
That's the fear.
That's the fear. So that's one of the pressures for sure, is their own expectations about that. Now, what about parents? You know, I mean, parents mean well. Of course they want their kids to be happy. But when I say this story about the woman who says, I know my daughter better than she knows herself, so she should listen to me when making career and educational choices, what do you think is going on inside the parent when they say things like that?
You know, honestly, Mark, I think parenting is the hardest job in the world. I just think it's probably the most challenging one. It's probably the most important one anyone will ever have. And I feel for the parent who says that, because I can hear how that could be and how they could honestly believe that and truly, they only want the well-being of their kids. They really do. And they're trying to direct and guide what that could look like through their own beliefs and their own experience. And they've lived it, and it's real for them. The fear of making the wrong choice or doing something that's going to waste time or not be you or get into the wrong career, the wrong job. You know, it sounds like this has happened to them or they fear something like that happened to their child. So therefore they believe, being the adult, that they've lived more experience and lived and had more experience that they know.
Yes.
And they do know their own experience to me, they know their own life and it's their own reality, their own perception. They don't know necessarily that what's the right career for their child or daughter, because it isn't a one in a box answer to that. So I think that it's just a mindset shift, and to know that as long as, you know, they're going to guide in a way that's helpful, that says, you know what, I'm behind you no matter what you do. It's a trust issue that they're not necessarily trusting their teenager or child to know what's best for them.
Yes.
And what does that say to the child?
Exactly.
You know, that's a big thing.
One of the perspectives of that parent, as I probed a little bit with the parent, was this idea of wasting time. And, you know, I had shared a career story out loud with that group, and there was some twists and turns in that story, as there are in so many's. And if we listen to Andrew Fitzgerald's story, you know, the parent listening to Andrew's story might have said, gee, he could have just picked the art gallery thing right out of MBA school, and he would have been happy, didn't have to waste all that time doing all that other banking stuff. And yet, you know, the story wouldn't be the story. The person wouldn't have had those experiences. The desires might not have finally come through. So, you know, when parents say, gee, I don't want my kid to waste time with all these unproductive things, you know, that they could just get it better sooner if they just listened to me.
Mark, they're I don't think they're really deeply thinking about the child. I think that they're associating that with themselves.
Yeah, so it's a kind
of
projection.
When I hear that, it just feels so real that they don't want to waste time. They felt like they have or don't want to, or that's their fear.
Yes.
That's coming through, and it's not necessarily what the child cares about at all.
So we're right into this really important conversation. There's 10 minutes left in the show. I just want to let listeners know, if they have an experience, either of their own experience with their parents telling them what to do or not to do, or if you're a parent of a teenager, please give us a call. You can call in with a comment or a question at 946-7000. That's area code 416-946-7000. And also, I've got my email here if you want to send an email with a question. I can read it aloud. It's Mark with a K, mark@careercycles.com. So your question or comment, 946-7000 in the 416, or mark@careercycles.com. So Leanne, back to the parent who's kind of projecting their fears onto their kid. What about the kid's perspective now, you know, and trying to both satisfy their parents, because they don't want to get their parents upset with them, but they also want to have their own lives. And how to balance that? What's the right thing? When to confront the parents and when not to confront the parents? Let's try and get inside the hearts and minds of the young person, him or herself.
Yeah, and Mark, I think that's a tricky thing to do, because we're looking at so many unique circumstances and people's culture and background and how they've grown up, that it would be a hard thing to do. But I do think if they follow a fast, just a really quick question that they can ask themselves of what feels better. Does it feel better right now to listen to that? Does it make sense to listen to the parent right now? or does it not? Which feels better to do? And that they'll be guided by that. I've had worked with a lot of people who initially went with what their parents wanted them to do and loved it, you know. And then I've worked with a lot of people who went with initially what somebody else wanted and didn't like it.
Yeah.
And made a change later on. But again, our career, as you say, is a journey. So we're going to learn what we don't like, and we're going to learn what we do like. And as we go through it, we can go and kind of focus more on what we do want as we learn and grow and experience these different workplaces, environments. Again, what we want and what we don't want, the skills we need, all of those things. So it's never necessarily a mistake, because when we feel that it's a mistake, then we feel regret and we feel like we should have done it earlier. Whereas if we can say, wait a minute, this is just something I learned, and now I can do it. Now I can actually apply some of these skills and abilities in whatever I do next, then it's a gift in a way, isn't it?
Yeah,
so it's really how you view it, and it's hard to say everyone should listen to their parents or don't listen to their parents. Like, it's not that simple, but if they can listen, like I liked what Andrew Fitzgerald just said about how listening to your heart, and it does, you know, it can sound cliche, like listen to what feels better moment to moment.
Yeah, well, Andrew Fitzgerald said that he listened to his heart when he was finally 46 years of age.
Yes.
You know, and that's so interesting. Like, it's important. In his story, what was also interesting, and I don't know if you caught it at the very beginning, you know, part of his influence toward a business career in banking came from, well, his dad, from a parental influence. And I think that's the case for many of us.
Yeah.
And yet it propelled him through so many different twists and turns, and it allowed him to really develop this demonstrated interest that eventually became his career, you know, in his 40s.
And that's exactly what I mean when I say it. You just never know where these things are going to, how they're going to come about. You know, it's not a black and white straight line lots of times. It's there's twists and turns to your career and your life, and as long as you can look at it with more of a positive mindset, then it's only going to help you moving forward.
Right on. Mm-hmm. And now all these people who are trying to help, like in that talk that I was mentioning off the top of this little piece of the show, I mentioned some guidance counselors. There was educators there. There were in Ontario here, we have a grade 10 course called Careers. And if you go to public school in Ontario, you got to take it. And then there are guidance counselors, and they also have some influence. And it was so interesting to hear that one of the guidance counselors talk about that parents are wrong. They don't understand what's required. They have their own ideas of what their kids should do, going to engineering school, going to this or that program. The parents might not understand what's required. I think the guidance counselor was coming at it from the point of view of the parent is so often projecting their own desires onto their kid, and that's why he says something like the parents are wrong.
Yeah, and it doesn't come into place of right or wrong. It's just from their own background of what, like you said, what they've experienced or what they wanted so badly, either for themselves, their family, their culture. There's so much involved in that. But again, it's what you do have with the question you just asked, with the guidance counselor, the parents, and the person who they're talking about, the student that's wondering what to do next. All of these people just want well-being. They just want to feel better with the choices they're making, and they want to know, they're all trying to be helpful to each other. And I think it's important that to know that when you listen to what's inside you, what really is calling you, and listen to things that make you feel good as you do them, you'll just be led there. And it doesn't, if you're a lawyer being led there, or if you're a chef being led there, or if you're someone who's doing coaching being led there, does it really matter? You're still going to get there. You're still who you are.
Yeah,
to be something else. You're still you in that role.
Right. There's a degree of faith that things are going to unfold, and there's also a degree of self-awareness and reflection that sometimes young people don't have, and that's exactly where I think the help can be most effective, is drawing that young person out. There was so much about, in that talk, there was so much about people telling young people what to do or what not to do, and there wasn't that much conversation about the kinds of questions that can be asked to draw that young person out so that they become more aware of their own
desires. That's what you're for, Mark. Career cycle.
We've got a couple more minutes. If people do have comments or questions, we might be able to squeeze one call or email on. So again, it's 416-946-7000, 416-946-7000, or mark@careercycles.com. So, Leanne, a couple of questions. Like, if you had a young person sitting in front of you and they're coming to you like with all this confusion, and my parents are breathing down my neck and my guidance counselor says this, what are some questions we can ask people just to help them draw themselves out and start to see their own story, their own strengths, and their own interests come to the fore?
Well, I know you know these, Mark, but I'll name a couple of them that I really like. And I think that when you can ask somebody, even when they're, let's say they're 18 years old or 16, and they're saying, I don't know what's next, or what do I take in school or courses, ask them what kinds of things they did when they were really, really little, as young as they can go in their minds. Like, what did they like? And they say, well, I used to do the sandbox, or when in kindergarten, or I used to play a lot of games, or I used to like to watch TV. I like to do, and you just kind of ask them those kinds of questions, and they ask themselves, what was it in those things that they enjoyed so much? Because they may not be playing in the sand anymore, but they may like to use their hands.
Right on.
Or they may like to do something that's, you know, what someone said to me the other day, they like to paint. Well, do you still like to paint? No, but I really like to create things. Okay, well then, how, you know, and it's just, it depends, what you say in those early years, there's a theme in your life.
Right on. Leanne, we have one caller here. We've got about a minute.
Great.
Laura, you're on the air here. What comment or question do you have on this topic?
Oh, hi there. Yeah, I was just listening to your show, and I was thinking of my own experience growing up where I was very much pressured to go a different route that I felt I was interested in or good at, and fortunately I was able to defy my parents and continue in the route that I wanted to. So when I had children of my own, I was very much a proponent of not pushing them and let them kind of develop their own skills and interests. And I think a great degree of what I felt I had to do and consequently did was to have, you know, very much a lot of faith in my children's choices. And fortunately, each of them did go the ways that they, you know, they did follow their interests and did have a feeling of what they were good at. And in terms of, you know, taking too much time or wasting time, my daughter presently, she's 27, she's done a few degrees, and she wasn't quite sure which path she was going in. And presently she is in Spain learning Spanish because she has finally decided after the previous degrees that she's done and volunteer work that she has done, that she wants to choose the path of international development.
Right on. So, Laura, you know what? I got to hold you there because we're just at the end of the